You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, focused on the fringe of Canada.
Through my work on Nighttime, I've been very fortunate to have made connections with so many fascinating and talented people. In fact, the success of the show has as much to do with the contributions of my guests and collaborators as it has to do with anything I do. Going forward, to make the show the best it can be, I only hope to increase the participation of the many friends of Nighttime. This episode will serve as a step in that direction. Turns out I found a kindred spirit and like-minded collaborator in a local crime writer named Bev Keddy. Regular Nighttime listeners will remember him as a guest in my series of episodes covering the disappearance of Troy Cook. But for those of you who don't know Bev, he's one of the less hated writers working for Halifax's long-running and quite controversial tabloid, Frank Magazine. Although Frank is best known for reporting on the many scandals and misdeeds of Nova Scotia's more prominent citizens, the publication does offer Bev Keddy a few pages in each episode to share his research into Nova Scotia's many unsolved murders. Although Bev's articles may only span a page or two, the work he puts into these pieces is deserving of a long-form article. His passion to shine a light on these stories leads him to interview affected families, gather historic documents, visit the scenes. Basically, Bev is a bit obsessive, and he gets wrapped up in every case he covers, something I can definitely relate to. After working together with Bev on the Troy Cook series, we both felt the opportunity was there for future collaborations. Specifically, we saw the opportunity in giving Bev's Frank Magazine articles a second life as topics on Nighttime. Tonight's story will serve as our maiden voyage together. Before recording this episode, Bev provided me with information on some of the recent cases he covered, and we decided to focus our first episode on the unsolved 1981 murder of then 80-year-old Sadie Rogers. As you'll hear in our discussion, police responded to a call from a neighbor of Sadie's who claimed that she uncharacteristically hadn't been seen in days and that her mail was beginning to pile up. When police entered Sadie's home, they'd be met by Amherst, Nova Scotia's most notorious murder case. Once we settled on discussing Sadie's case, Bev and I hunkered down at my dining room table, poured some coffee, and got into it. What you hear next is our conversation surrounding the murder of Sadie Rogers. Hello, listeners. I'm sure you've already heard the announcement and bought tickets, but in case you don't know, I'm coming to Toronto on July 22nd to co-host the Canadian Crime Podcast event. Although the event is going to be great and I'm excited to meet you all, there has been one detail that's really been taking the wind out of my sails. See, I hate traveling, I hate airports, and most of all, I hate the ugly, featureless carry-on bag that I lug around the airport like a fool. This has been bothering so much, I was even considering backing out of the event. But luckily, that's all behind me now. I've been saved by the geniuses at Away and their perfect luggage. Away was born from the pain suffered while traveling and inspired by true travel stories like yours and mine. Using that as their starting point, Away designed a bag that solved a few old problems like terrible wheels and solved a few new ones like dead cell phone batteries. The end result is first-class luggage at coach price. Let me make your life better by getting you hip to Away. They use quality materials and keep the price reasonable by cutting out the middleman and selling direct to you. Their bags come in a variety of colors and sizes. Away provides peace of mind with both a no-hassle 100-day trial and a lifetime warranty. Away will ship to the lower 48 states for free. As I'm a bit of a weekend warrior type, I opted for the carry-on, which is Away's smaller size bag, and I absolutely love it. Not only is it stylish, lightweight, and spacious, it has one feature that I consider a game-changer. Conveniently located right below the extendable handle is a friggin' charger. That's right, the bag has a portable charger built in with enough juice to charge your phone five times. If you travel, don't waste your life the way I've wasted the past 30-something years of mine. Go to awaytravel.com/night, and when you get to checkout, use promo code NIGHT and get $20 off a suitcase. Again, that's awaytravel.com/night, and use promo code NIGHT for $20 off a suitcase you will love. When you buy one, email me to let me know, and I'll send you some nighttime stickers to put on it. Bev, just to set it up, could you just tell me a bit about where this story was set, the time frame that it was set? You know, when did this happen?
Well, she was last seen on Saturday, September 26, 1981. And up to that point, like, she was 80 years old, she'd never been married, had no children, lived by herself in the same house on 112 Cordova Street in the town of Amherst, Nova Scotia. She had been living there since 1935, when her mom and her moved to Amherst. Her mom died in 1953, and Sadie kept living there. So the community knew her, she knew them. They always looked out for her. So when she was last seen on that date, September 26, 1981, people started to get worried.
Now, Amherst, like, for people who aren't from this part of Nova Scotia, right, not a major city.
No.
But I guess to some would be kind of a hub city, because if you're leaving from Nova Scotia to New Brunswick, would you not pass through Amherst?
You pretty much have to.
Yeah. And in 81, when this murder occurred, what would, even roughly, do you know roughly what the population of Amherst, like, what size city are we talking about?
Probably back then around 96, 9700 people, and it's even fewer today, about 9400 people today.
Mm-hmm. And where Sadie would be, again, as you had just described, she's lived there her whole life. So it's not like she's somebody who is passing through a, you know, a sketchy apartment building or something.
Well, not her whole life, no. She was 80 years old in 1981. So she was born around the turn of the century. So okay, she moved there when she was in her mid-30s.
Oh, she did. Okay.
Right.
And at that point, living with her mother, they lived in this house. So this was, although not the house she was born in, she was no stranger to the people around there.
Absolutely not, no.
Mm-hmm. Now, prior to the murder, she was, again, you said 81 when this occurred.
Yes.
What was her life like at that point? I don't believe she was retired, but what kind of things was she known to be involved in?
She was a gal who worked as a housekeeper for the most part and never made a whole lot of money. Housekeepers typically live on, I wouldn't say the fringes of society, but they certainly are never going to be making the kinds of dollars that would make someone wealthy by any means. And, of course, by that age, she would have been getting the old age pension as well. And that's a big clue later on as to when she was last seen and when she may have been killed.
So she was just your typical little old lady, except she was still working at a older age. But I guess maybe in 81, I don't know how uncommon it would be in 1981 to be working at 81 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
But as it doesn't seem like there's really anything about her that would lead to a high-risk lifestyle.
Absolutely not, no.
Yeah, and from what I read from your article and the various articles you sent me, is she lived a pretty predictable lifestyle and a predictable schedule. Her neighbors, you know, were used to seeing her outside at the certain times of day, you know, on a routine. And I guess that was what led to it being obvious something was up. Do you recall in your research what it was that led people to be concerned for Sadie?
Well, she was last seen on that Saturday, September 26th, and old age pension checks were delivered on Monday, which would have been the 28th of September. And she would have normally just, you know, grabbed that check right away, but she did not. So people started to get worried that because her mail had not been touched, that by Friday, October 2nd, that's when they called the police and said, "Can you please look in on Sadie for us?"
Mm-hmm. So mail was piling up. I wonder if the people who reported it, I don't know if you know this, was it like a bank or someone like from her professional life, or was it like a neighbor, or do you have any idea?
I'm guessing it was a neighbor, one of her neighbors or one of her extended family.
Yeah, so I can imagine a mailbox full of letters, maybe a couple newspapers on the step is kind of the scene I'm picturing.
Yeah, and most importantly, her uncashed check. This is back before direct deposit. If you remember, you're a young man, Jordan. Maybe you don't remember the concept of paper checks.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay, all right. That's how I get paid at Frank Magazine. Yeah.
So somebody had been concerned about Sadie, mail piling up. She maybe wasn't meeting appointments or being where she normally would have been leading up to it. Police are involved. The police respond to the calls for concern for Sadie. What do the police find when they show up?
They show up at her home and they find her upstairs in her bedroom having been killed. And it was later revealed that she had been stabbed to death. Now, I read one of the early newspaper reports from the Amherst Daily News, written by a guy named Doug Harkness, who is quite well known in local media. He had a very long career, Doug Harkness did. And he reported that a neighbor had said that she did not sleep upstairs. She slept on the main level. So it was odd enough that she was even up there in the first place. And 10 years before, around 1970, she had been robbed in her home, so she was very leery of strangers. So I'm not sure how much company she would ever have had. Mm-hmm. But as a result of the earlier robbery, she would never have opened her house to anyone that she didn't know.
Let alone go up. Yeah, and it's just the whole upset. I guess we would be... It's just we're left to speculation as to why she was upstairs.
Yeah.
So the police arrive. They find her upstairs, which isn't where she normally would spend her time, stabbed to death.
Yeah.
How gruesome are we talking? Do you know the details of her, the injuries?
I've never seen a full description, just that she had been stabbed to death, and people don't usually write out those kinds of details. Mm-hmm. I mean, the police would know, but they certainly have never revealed that. In fact, they've always been reluctant to say how she's even murdered, but people just seem to know from those early reports and gossiping and rumor-mongering that she had been stabbed to death.
In 1994, Karen Summers was killed in a drive-by shooting. She was 19. The next day, the police found a man with the car and the gun.
The police came on to question me, and what's so crazy, I have the gun on me. But they wasn't after me, so all I know is I had a murder weapon on me, and they let me go.
And 1 year later, Karen's murder trial ended in a conviction. But the thing is, they convicted the wrong man.
Oh, I remember when they said guilty, I recall crying. I went back to the cell and cried. It was like, you know, they tell me a life in 170 years, I'm never getting out of prison.
After a shocking death row confession.
I wasn't trying to shoot Karen Summers. I was just, and she was in the wrong place at the wrong time. But I shot Karen Summers.
And a man's life was changed forever.
Buried alive is what I was for 22 years. Not literally. I look forward to speaking. I definitely want y'all to tune in.
The true story of DeMarco Carpenter on the podcast, Buried Alive.
Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you get your podcasts. Well, like when I think of an older lady murdered in her home, I'm kind of left, most often I'm thinking two things may have happened. There could have been a burglary, robbery gone wrong. The other alternative is somebody close to her, family member, she, you know, had a bad relationship or something of that nature. Do you know of any evidence of a break-in or robbery or burglary?
Well, later on, many, many years later, this has been a persistent story in the Amherst area. People from that part of the province know about Sadie Rogers, and there are still periodic reports in the paper. Mm-hmm. One of them was that... And this is pure speculation that she did know the person who killed her because, and then the person who killed her knew the house because it looked as if the window to the door, like the screen door, had been lifted up, removed so that they could undo the latch and let themselves in. So the person had to have known that much about the house, mm-hmm. and they probably knew the house layout well enough that they can make their way through it without tripping over things.
Interesting.
And the speculation is that she was asleep and that she was awakened by someone in her home rifling through things and recognized who it was, and this person killed her.
And when you say glass removed from the door, I remember reading this. Removed from the door is different from broken. Like it was somebody carefully took it
out. Yes, yes.
And that would, like, again, just thinking out loud, but it seems like it'd be the kind of thing where you wouldn't just test that on a door. It was probably a defect that maybe people knew, that somebody knew about.
Something oddly specific about that door.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, there's a window in the back of my house that doesn't really latch. If that was the window somebody got in, you know, it would just be a pretty big coincidence that they tested that.
And how many people would have known something like that? Not many.
When I read the story initially, my theory led more towards... like that would support my theory is that it was someone close to her. You mentioned earlier that this was leading to, this occurred just around the time she would have received her pension check.
Yes.
So for any of the young ones out there who don't know what that is, basically once a month on a set date, a senior would receive a check to, you know, to cash and pay their bills.
It's usually the third to last business day of any given month.
So when Sadie was last seen was right around the time she should have received her check. And somebody who was close to her and desperate would likely know she was about to receive a couple hundred dollars.
Yeah, and this is my speculation. I have no way of knowing this, but if she was last seen on Saturday, I think she was probably killed that Saturday, that evening.
And you know, in an odd twist, one thing I came across when I was reading, I was paying a lot of attention to the pension check, seeing as that I couldn't see any other motive. Right. Whenever you hear of a senior murdered, almost always it's, you know, it's for money, from whether it's someone close to her or a robbery gone wrong.
There's always a perception that old folks have money.
Yeah, for better or worse, or more accurate or not. But in her case, the pension check was one of the things left in the mailbox and the police showed up. And what I had read that it was something had happened with the mail. Her pension check was actually a couple days late.
Yes.
So if I'm grasping for straws on what may have happened, I could picture a situation where somebody's demanding a check and she's saying, I don't have it, thus leading to a robbery gone wrong.
Yeah, it's just a pure rage. Say, where's your money? I don't have it. And therefore, the guy just unleashed on her. That could be what happened, yes.
It's just the pieces would fit. But again, without any evidence of, as far as I know, nothing was ever found to tie it to a suspect. Are you aware of any suspect?
I am not aware of any suspects whatsoever. Mm-hmm.
In the part of Amherst she was in, just thinking of a random robbery, if it wasn't somebody who knew her, do you know if this was like a, considered like a rougher part of town, or do you have any idea?
I don't know the Amherst very well at all. Back in the 80s, I would have known even less, but I don't know. It was 112 Cordova Street, and it's probably a working class part of town, but it's a working class town anyway, so I don't know. If it would be any rougher or not, I don't think it would have been.
But it's not known as a, like Amherst in general isn't known as a rough part. Like I read actually that this was the first murder there. I think it was, I don't know how many years, but it was so long that the murder before this ended in the death sentence with somebody hung in like, you know, the center of town.
It was the 1930s. There were two people who killed a woman and they were hanged for it. And I'm trying to find the names of these guys because they deserve to have their names known. But back in the 1930s, there were two men named Smith and Henwood who murdered a woman on Croft Street, and they got hanged for it. And there was some kind of spousal abuse thing in the 1940s as well, where a woman may have been murdered by her husband, but that last actual murder by someone who didn't know them was back in the 1930s.
Wow. I guess that just puts in perspective what kind of town it was. Where exactly. This not the kind of place you just get stabbed in your bed.
No. Yeah. And I'm not aware of any kind of murder in the Amherst area since 1981. It's a really quiet town to this day.
Now, in the years since this murder, again, the police, you've had mentioned the police and the community basically has kept the story alive with periodic updates in the newspaper and whatnot. Are you aware of any movement in the case since this has occurred, or is it?
These are just articles that appear every few years. The Amherst Daily News, or whatever it's called these days, there's a reporter there who contacts family members and friends every couple of years, and they issue a fresh article. No new information per se, except that every once in a while there's a little nugget like that thing about the door that I mentioned. But by and large, there's just so little new to report that I think it's just reporters' efforts to help keep the story alive. But
yeah, I guess like something like this, the investigators are likely keeping their cards pretty close to their chest, where if they don't have much and there's any suspicion that it's like an inside job or someone close to her.
Yeah, I mean, I typically police know things that they don't tell us. And the reasons for that, of course, the main reason is that the murderer would know things that we don't, and therefore they may inadvertently blab that thing, and therefore they would fall heavily under police suspicion. But the specifics of what those things would be, I would have no idea whatsoever.
And when you did this story in Frank Meg, were you in touch with her family or anyone really close to Sydney?
I tried to contact some family members and I didn't have any luck. Mm-hmm. It's hard to track people down.
Especially when you're talking a crime that affected an 80-year-old 30 years ago. So yeah. Her children...
She had no children. She was childless.
She was wow. So, okay. So we're talking about the people who would be close to her, nieces and nephews. Yeah. 30 years ago, they would have been probably in their 60s, yeah. 50s. So, yeah. So it's a case like this. Someone got away with murder. The victim's close friends and family are likely not here anymore. Yeah. So the definitive cold case.
Pretty much, yes. And it's just sad because this lady was a dear, sweet old lady. You're going to run a picture or two of her on the podcast, I'm sure. And she just she didn't deserve this whatsoever, and then yet this was her fate, and it's just really, really sad that there's some son of a bitch out there who has never been caught for killing this poor woman.
I want to end this episode by sending my deepest condolences to the surviving family members of Sadie Rogers. In hearing about Sadie's life, I couldn't help but think of my own loved ones. I can't imagine what you must be feeling. And if anyone has any information that may lead to an arrest in Sadie's murder, please tell law enforcement what you know. There's presently a reward of up to $150,000 available. So do the right thing and contact the Rewards for Major Unsolved Crimes program. You can call them at 1-888-710-9090. And with that, we'll conclude this episode of Nighttime. I want to thank Bev Keddie for being involved in this episode and for the great work he's doing raising awareness in the unsolved crimes he chooses to cover. Bev, you're the real deal. I'm glad to know you and I'm proud to have you involved in Nighttime. Here's a short message to listeners of the show Bev provided.
If you know anything about this or any other unsolved Nova Scotia-based crime, please contact me at bev@frankmagazine.ca. That's bev@frankmagazine.ca. I guarantee anonymity if you ask for it.
I want to thank Frank Magazine editor Andrew Douglas for allowing Bev's article to get their second life here on Nighttime. If you enjoy Bev's reporting or simply want to stay up to date on the sex appetites or the many malfeasances of our politicians and business leaders, go and buy Frank Magazine. Also, you can save some cash and avoid having to make small talk with people by subscribing to Frank online at frankmagazine.ca. If you're interested in hearing more content, please check out the Nighttime Patreon group. It's $1 a month, and you can support the show and at the same time gain access to the supporter-exclusive bonus content, such as videos, bonus audio, and prior episodes that are no longer available in this main feed. I'd like to thank the current patrons of the show and welcome the newest members to the group. Kirby R., I sincerely appreciate you supporting Nighttime and becoming a patron last month. Without you and the other patrons, the show wouldn't be possible. And for anyone else who'd like to support the show but can't help financially, you can give me a big hand by telling your friends about me and by leaving a positive review on Apple Podcasts or any equivalent. If any of you listening want to stay up to date with my activities on and off this show, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I use the handle @NighttimePod. If you have any story ideas or feedback on the show, I'd love to hear from you at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com. So until next time, keep looking around and let me know if you see anything weird.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.